Oh, wrap me in my country's flag and lay me in the cold blue sea, and let the roaring of the waves my solemn requiem be. And I shall sleep a pleasant sleep while storms above their vigils keep. My captain brave shall read for me the service of the silent dead, and yea, shall o'er me in the waves when all the prayers are said. And I will find my long, long home among the billows and the foam.
Hello, Radioland. You're listening to 91.7 WHUS Stores. I'm your host, Graham Stinnett. This is another episode of Darshiv, and in fact, it is a part two to a conversation that we have started with fellow archivist Melissa Waterworth Batt regarding Charles Olson, Herman Melville, and Moby Dick. And we're going to begin to return to that conversation by playing at length the Goddard College opening of the book Charles Olson wrote, Call Me Ishmael, and he starts it out as first fact. You've heard the first minute of this, but hearing it in its entirety gives you a bit more of a sense of where it was grounded.
I don't have too much sense of how much of Melville you all know. Like Paul Weiner says, I hadn't realized that Moby Dick had become a school classic like Lawrence said it was. My father gave it to me when I was a kid, and that's a lucky way to get it if you can, I guess. I opened the book with this called First Fact as prologue. Herman Melville was born in New York August 1st, 1819, and on the 12th of that month, the Essex, a well-found whaler of 238 tons, sailed from Nantucket with George Pollard Jr. as captain, Owen Chase and Matthew Joy mates, six of her complement of 20 men, Negroes, bound for the Pacific Ocean, victualled and provided for 2.5 years. A year and 3 months later, on November 20th, 1820, just south of the equator in longitude 119 west, this ship, on a calm day, with the sun at ease, was struck head-on twice by a bull whale, a spermaceti about 85 feet long, and with her bow stove in, filled and sank. Her 20 men set out in three open whaleboats for the coast of South America, 2,000 miles away. They had bread, 200 pound of boat, water, 65 gallons, and some Galapagos turtles. Although they were at the time at no great distance from Tahiti, they were ignorant of the temper of the natives and feared cannibalism. Their first extreme sufferings commenced a week later when they made the mistake of eating, in order to make their supply last, some bread which had got soaked by the sea's wash. To alleviate the thirst which followed, they killed turtle for its blood. The sight revolted the stomachs of the men. In the first weeks of December, their lips began to crack and swell, and a glutinous saliva collected in the mouth, intolerable to the taste. Their bodies commenced to waste away and possessed so little strength they had to assist each other in performing some of the body's weakest functions. Barnacles collected on the boat's bottoms, and they tore them off for food. A few flying fish struck their sails, fell into the boats, and were swallowed raw. After a month of the open sea, they were gladdened by the sight of a small island, which they took to be Ducey, but was Elizabeth Isle. Currents and storm had taken them 1,000 miles off their course. They found water on the island after a futile search for it from rocks which they picked at where moisture was with their hatchets. It was discovered in a small spring in the sand at the extreme verge of ebb tide. They could gather it only at low water. The rest of the time, the sea flowed over the spring to the depth of 6 feet. 20 men could not survive on the island, and to give themselves the chance to reach the mainland before the supplies they had from the ship should be gone, 17 of them put back to sea, December 27th. The three who stayed, Thomas Chappell of Plymouth, England, and William Wright and Seth Weeks of Barnstable, Massachusetts, took shelter in caves among the rocks. In one they found 8 human skeletons side by side, as though they had lain down and died together. The only food the three had was a sort of blackbird which they caught when it roosted in trees and whose blood they sucked. With the meat of the bird and a few eggs, they chewed a plant tasting like peppergrass, which they found in the crevices of the rocks. They survived. The three boats, with the 17 men divided among them, moved under the sun across the ocean together until the 12th of January, when during the night, the one under the command of Owen Chase, first mate, became separated from the other two. Already one of the 17 had died, Matthew Joy, second mate. He'd been buried January 10th. When Charles Shorter, Negro, out of the same boat as Joy, died on January 23rd, his body was shared among the men of that boat and the captains and Eaton. 2 days more and Lawson Thomas, Negro, died and was eaten. Again 2 days and Isaac Shepherd, Negro, died and was eaten. The bodies were roasted to dryness by means of fires kindled on the ballast sand at the bottom of the boats. 2 days later, the 29th, during the night, the boat which had been Matthew Joy's got separated from the captains and was never heard of again. When she disappeared, 3 men still lived: William Bond, Negro, Obed Hendricks, and Joseph West. In the captain's boat, now alone on the sea, 4 men kept on. The 5th, Samuel Reed, Negro, had been eaten for strength at his death the day before. Within 3 days, these 4 men, calculating the miles they had to go, decided to draw 2 lots, one to choose who should die that the others might live, and one to choose who should kill him. The youngest, Owen Coffin, serving on his first voyage as a cabin boy to learn his family's trade, lost. It became the duty of Charles Ramsdale, also of Nantucket, to shoot him. He did, and he, the captain, and Brazilla Ray, Nantucket, ate him. That was February 1st, 1821. On February 11th, Ray died of himself and was eaten. On February 23rd, the captain and Ramsdale were picked up by the Nantucket whale ship Dolphin, Captain Zimri Cook. The men in the 3rd boat under the command of Owen Chase, the first mate, held out the longest. They had become separated from the other 2 boats before hunger and thirst had driven any of the Essex men to extremity. Owen Chase's crew had buried their first death, Richard Peterson, Negro, on January 20th. It was not until February 8th, when Isaac Cole died in convulsions, that Owen Chase was forced, some 2 weeks later than in the other boats, to propose to his 2 men, Benjamin Lawrence and Thomas Nickerson, that they should eat of their own flesh. It happened to them this once in this way. They separated the limbs from the body and cut all the flesh from the bones, after which they opened the body, took out the heart, closed the body again, sewed it up as well as they could, and committed it to the sea. They drank of the heart and ate it. They ate a few pieces of the flesh and hung the rest, cut in thin strips, to dry in the sun. They made a fire, as the captain had, and roasted some to serve them the next day. The next morning they found that the flesh in the sun had spoiled, had turned green. They made another fire to cook it to prevent its being wholly lost. For 5 days they lived on it, not using of their remnant of bread. They recruited their strength on the flesh, eating it in small pieces with salt water. By the 14th they were able to make a few attempts at guiding the boat with an oar. On the 15th, the flesh was all consumed, and they had left the last of their bread, 2 sea biscuits. Their limbs had swelled during the last 2 days and now began to pain them excessively. They judged they still had 300 miles to go. On the 17th, the settling of a cloud led Chase to think that land was near. Notwithstanding, the next morning, Nickerson, 17 years of age, after having bailed the boat, laid down, drew a piece of canvas up over him, and said that he then wished to die immediately. On the 19th, at 7 in the morning, Lawrence saw a sail at 7 miles, and the three of them were taken up by the brig Indian of London, Captain William Crozier. It is not known what happened in later years to the three men who survived the island, but the four Nantucket men who, with the captain, survived the sea all became captains themselves. They died old, Nickerson at 77, Ramsdale, who was 19 on the Essex, at 75, Chase, who was 24, at 73, Lawrence, who was 30, at 80, and Pollard, the captain, who had been 31 at the time, lived until 1870, age 81. The captain, on his return to Nantucket, took charge of the ship Two Brothers, another whaler, and 5 months from home struck a reef to the westward of the Sandwich Islands. The ship was a total loss, and Pollard never went to sea again. At the time of the second wreck, he said, "Now I am utterly ruined. No owner will ever trust me with a whaler again, for all will say I am an unlucky man." He ended his life as the night watch of Nantucket Town, protecting the houses and people in the dock. Owen Chase was always fortunate. In 1832, the Charles Carroll was built for him on Brant Point, Nantucket, and he filled her twice, each time with 2,600 barrels of sperm oil. In his last years, he took to hiding food in the attic of his house.
This account, which opens the book Call Me Ishmael by Charles Olson, is drawn directly from Owen Chase's narrative of the Essex, which was sort of the prime moving story that helped Herman Melville depict the whale, or Moby Dick, and leading to his great classic. Let's now return to my conversation with archivist Melissa Waterworth Batt from the Yukon Archives to talk a little bit more about Charles Olson during the war years, his leaving Washington, and his return to literature through Herman Melville.
In the 1940s, Olson takes a series of jobs. In 1940, he's publicity director for the American Civil Liberties Union, and then he's the head of the Foreign Language Information Service of the Common Council for American Unity. It's the headquarters in New York City, where they're focusing on, you know, racial and ethnic discrimination toward immigrant communities. They're trying to support those communities. And then he goes on to be sort of invited to Washington, D.C. to be the representative of that organization and to lobby on behalf of immigration reform. In 1942 to 44, he works at the Office of War Information in Washington, D.C., where he's head of the Foreign Language Division as associate head. He resigns in protest over the issue of censorship in 1944. And what we know now, I think, about the Office of War Information in D.C. is it very much was serving as a propaganda tool or department during the war, towards the end of the war. And Olson rejects that, and he goes to Key West, and in the notebooks from that time, you see him making this stance. He's declaring sort of independence for himself. He does not want to work in politics. He does not want to be involved in any kind of political economy that's going to happen after the war. And in fact, he turns away from the Democratic National Committee and forges his own path as a writer. That's when in 1950 we see Projective Verse come out, where his theories about poetry have gone into full flower and full detail about the power that he thought that creative writing could have for modern times. The father of postmodernism, if you will.
Let's listen again to a segment of Letter to Melville. This time it's a different recording. This is Olson, who was recorded at his home in Gloucester in 1968, actually a year before he died. you can kind of hear the differences in the sound. You know, he's got some gravitas that wasn't really there in the same delivery in the previous recordings that we've played. And what's interesting about this one is that it was recorded by Ann Charters, who the Archives also has a sort of extensive relationship and collection in various capacities from. She basically developed a series of poems, recollections, recordings, images, photography from her time in the Berkshires. She actually created a sort of folio box of what was called Melville in the Berkshires. And it includes this recording that she did with Charles Olson doing a reading of the letter to Melville from 1951, but again recorded in 1968. This was on a sort of independent record label slash small press imprint that Sam and Ann Charters put together in 1963, and it's called Portents, which is a quote term used by Herman Melville, which he opens his book Battle Pieces, which we mentioned previously about his Civil War poetry. And Portents is a kind of a referent to John Brown and the oncoming Civil War in the mid-19th century. And note, he kind of starts by addressing individuals, and in those cases it's typically him addressing Melville's granddaughter, who he had a pretty close working relationship with. And there are other names that he drops as far as folks who have been involved in Melville scholarship or those close acquaintances of Herman Melville's, but just as some context, you know, his poetry is packed with names and symbolisms. But let's listen to Charles Olson kind of give us a bit more of that postmodernism in which you were just describing, Melissa. Here we go.
Myself, I'd like to extricate you who have the blood of him, and another who loves him as a doctor knows, a family doctor, how his mother stayed inside him, how the compact came out, hate, how and what this kept him from, despite how far he traveled. This matchbox, with a match for mass, goes backward gaily, bumping down the wake. What they'll forget, they'll smother you, is there is only one society, there is no other. How many we do not know where and why they read a book, and that the reading of a book can save for life. They do not come to banquets, and Nathaniel Hawthorne, whom Herman Melville loved, would not come, nor Raymond Weaver, who loved them both because they loved each other. You have the right to be there because you loved an old man's walk and took a little attic's box and books, and there's he, the doctor, beside you, whom I love, and by his presence with you, will speak for Melville and myself. He who was himself saved, who, because in the middle of the Atlantic an appendectomy was called for, read a sea story once, and since has gone by the pole star a scalpel overside, for rudder has moved on from Calypso, huge in the dispatch of a quicksilver god. Yet I wish that neither of you had mixed, as Lyda hasn't, in this middle place, in such salad as these caterers will serve. No, he'll skillfully confuse you. He knows such words as mythic, such adjectives that fall so easily you'll think it's true. Melville was a risky but creative bungling. How they put words on that this lad was so, who stowed himself with roaches and on blue shining corpse at age 16. Hey, Jackson, the diced bones. Now his too, he, who is also of the one society who likewise lifted altars too high, a typewriter in a tree, and spilled himself into the honey air, died the blonde ant, so pleasantly, as though he did not want to woo, to chance a bronze grave, preferred to choose his own diving place.
Well, in terms of the sort of final thoughts on Olson, mm-hmm. he turns away from Melville, is this correct?
That's right.
I mean, what do we make of that? Why is it that, you know, you described that he had an experience in the 1940s of kind of leaving, you know, his profession didn't really land in a certain way. He made some choices to move back into the literary field. What is it about Melville, or what is it about Olson, I guess, that kind of coincides with maybe some of these? I don't want to say like the bull charging into the the ship, but what about kind of turning away from something that you're so passionate about? What does that say about this work?
I think it says that we have to forge our own path, that we are, you know, Olson used to always make the argument that Melville needed to be read in the context of his time. And I'm afraid I don't have an English degree. I do have a history degree, so I'm probably culpable in some ways with that group of scholars that Olson sort of rejected. But I do think if you were an English reader, an English writer, I see scholars to this day coming to Olson's work, again, his originality and innovations in poetry as a way of studying all kinds of things, of looking back at Wordsworth, of looking at American claims of uniqueness. You know, Olson's work is being examined in terms of how he was taught at Harvard, how Western civilization was framed in the teaching and pedagogy of higher education. And then, of course, there's always poets coming to use Olson's papers that are looking to inform their own writing based on Olson's craft. And by that, I mean very specific things like the way he would journal to himself. What did Olson use to promote or promulgate, keep moving his art forward? He had dream journals. He, as we said, was widely read. He read popular magazines. He was a fan of archaeology. And then he always loved hearing what students were reading. So many of his students would go on to study classic Greek writers. And so in many ways, Olson's interest in the Homeric hymns began sort of an area of scholarship that some poets find really informative. So we've had poets from Ireland, Portugal, France, India come to study Olson's writing to inform their own writing practice. And in fact, one of Olson's poems has been put to music by the Brooklyn Chorus, a Brooklyn Children's Chorus, a couple years ago in celebrating sort of this historical period in Brooklyn history. And I can imagine that the composer found Olson's work on his own. Olson isn't widely anthologized. So if you're a student in college, you wouldn't necessarily find Olson's writing in your anthology. It would have to be referred to or mentioned by either other writers or, I don't know, a professor that had read him in his own past. So he circulated definitely outside the mainstream. I think Olson was trying to say, take risks with your art. Even though Olson, too, could never make a living necessarily as a poet. Many of his publications were not commercial publications. You know, he was supported in Gloucester by quite a big community of friends to the point where, you know, he could go to the local diner and they would feed him because he hadn't eaten for a while. And in fact, you know, he still has friends and family in the Gloucester area. So I don't know, Graham, what do you think? What could we take away from this curious call me Ishmael?
Yeah, it seems like my sense from it is that, you know, writing this primer is not even the output of the work that he sought to do. In my sense, it's actually the Melville Project. The cards themselves are like the archive was the work that he produced. Like, the book is interesting. It's fantastic that it's this quick little sketch and it has certain rhyme scheme to it in certain ways. And like, if you just look at the book, he jumps from like bold text to then like indented paragraphs to then like quotations. It's a very oddly structured book. And it's almost like that's just the play part of it. But the actual research is all of this stuff that he's trying to connect about lost objects, lost histories, lost artwork. And then he leaves these cards in a chest in a friend's basement. That gets flooded time and time again. Like, clearly he left Melville and probably left a piece of himself with it, and continued to be Charles Olson and do whatever Charles Olson does. But it's almost like the investment in and of itself was really the archive more than the book, in my opinion.
Well, what's fascinating about his 1940s history, right? And then 1947, he publishes Call Me Ishmael, and then he moves after he's been teaching at Black Mountain for a few years in the 50s. He moves to Gloucester, and it's where, again, he kind of leaves Melville aside and just goes forward in writing his own work, and doing lectures and spoken word readings.
Very cool. There's so much there. I know we could continue to talk, you know, the Maximus poems we didn't even really get to. We'll leave that for the audience to explore on their own. But thank you so much, Melissa, for this really informative conversation about Melville, Moby Dick, and Charles Olson, that we, of course, house the papers of the note cards, this project, at the Yukon Archives. Any final thoughts before we sign off?
Well, I think coming full circle, we started this with Olson talking about Melville, who in the year of his birth, the Essex was on its tragic voyage in search of the sperm whale. Well, maybe too, you and I were talking about how, you know, Melville traveled in circles of other writers. Did he ever meet Charles Dickens? Wouldn't they have so much in common? And what I found out recently is that, it's funny, in some strange, I was looking for a BBC documentary, and there's actually one called Dickens in America. So, in fact, when Melville was on the boat, Acushnet, going to the South Pacific, that's when Dickens was in the U.S., going on a tour, visiting mainly, doing lectures and readings, but also he wanted to see for himself if America was enlightened. He visited prisons. He visited mental health facilities. He went to factory housing. So he pretty much toured New England, the parts of the South, and then up through the Midwest. And that whole time, Melville was off on the Acushnet having this 2.5-year adventure.
If only. Thank you for enlightening me on that. That's also just fascinating to think that, you know, Melville's out in this extremely horrifying industry, right? Mm-hmm. Like, isn't that the representation of America's enlightenment?
That's right.
That basically takes on this industry from any other, and it becomes the primary driving force of so much of America's economy at that time. Mm-hmm. That's fascinating. That's like Alexis de Tocqueville coming in. checking us for our culture.
Well, thanks, Graham. It's been fun.
Excellent. Thanks for being on, Melissa. And we will catch everybody next time. I'm your host, Graham Stinnett. You've been listening to another episode of Darshiv on 91.7 WHUS Stores. For more information on the Archives and Special Collections, you can find us on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and the web. Our theme song is Dream in Cassio Tone by Arable Lands. Graphic design by Melika Stinnett. Thanks for listening, and we'll catch you next time.
My video.